Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the Court. My name is Aaron Stabell, and I represent the appellant Natural Father in this matter. Very simply this morning, the outcome in this case rests solely on whether this Court finds that the evidence underlying the judgment of the trial court terminating Natural Father's parental rights on the basis of Natural Father having willfully abandoned or willfully, substantially, and continuously neglecting to provide necessary care and protection of his child, quote, instantly tilts the scales in the affirmative when weighed against the evidence in opposition. This standard, this clear, cogent, and convincing standard of proof, is required because although as a society, as a state, we have erected a statutory construct to grant or deny petitions for adoption, the Supreme Court of the United States Constitution remind us that parents, of course, as we heard in the prior case, have a fundamental liberty interest in raising their children. In 2004, this Court said of the United States decision in Troxell that recognized or commented on this fundamental liberty interest, that this interest does not simply evaporate because parents have not been model parents. When the facts of this case, when the judgment of the trial court is viewed through the lens of the United States Constitution and the Missouri Constitution, and the cases flowing therefrom, particularly Meyer against Nebraska and Troxell, the United States Supreme Court, and then certainly the CMBR case in this court, when the case is viewed through the lens of the statute 453-040, I would suggest to this court that the fact as set forth before you do not instantly tilt the scales in the affirmative when weighed against the evidence in opposition, and therefore the trial court committed reversible error and the judgment and order terminating my client's parental rights and granting natural mother and stepfather's petition for adoption must be denied because, as I outlined in my brief, there was no it was against the weight of the evidence, whereas Judge Stith related in the CMBR case, there was no substantial evidence to support the decision in that case. In addition to the facts and law outlined in my brief, I wanted to take a moment to focus on this issue of neglect. I believe the issue of abandonment is clear in the brief. I think that one, the trial court was more clearly wrong in that case than in the neglect issue. The neglect issue, I believe the trial court also committed error, but I wanted to parse some important points on the neglect factor as it relates to some of the case law. I couldn't find a Missouri case law that said a parent's failure alone to pay child support meant that it was proper for a trial court to terminate their parental rights under the neglect prong of 453-040. Now, there are some cases that speak of a parent's failure to pay child support, but those cases don't rely solely on that factor. The three cases I looked at and that are outlined in the brief, but I don't think I did justice in my brief, but would like to talk about them a little bit this morning, are the JMJ case out of the Western District, the EKL case out of the Western District, and then the TSD case out of the Eastern District. In all three of those cases, the appellate courts noted that there had not been any child support payments. But those three cases, when it comes to the neglect prong, are all distinguishable from the facts that you have before you in this case. For example, in the JMJ case, there was a four-year period where a parent failed to pay any support. However, the court also noted that the natural mother didn't participate with the child in counseling, that the visits were sporadic, that there were no contacts over a 2 to 4 week period. And the court focused on mother's failure to provide what it called emotional support in addition to the financial support. In the EKL decision, a father had been incarcerated since a child's birth. Father had paid no child support, but the court also noted in that case the natural father didn't send any cards, letters, or have any other contact for the 5 years from the child's birth to the time of trial in this matter. Finally, in the TSD case, the court noted there that there was no support. But the natural mother, whose rights were terminated in that case, only saw the child once in approximately 9 to 10 years and had no contact with the child in the 6 months before filing the petition. I would suggest that the facts of the case before you are much different than those three cases, not only with respect to the support issue, which we can talk about here in a moment, but also with respect to the contact issue. There isn't any doubt.
If we're focusing on neglect,
yes, ma'am.
What is the standard or the definition of neglect that we apply in a 453 case?
Yes, ma'am. Neglect focuses on physical deprivation or harm and has been characterized as a failure to perform the duty with which the parent is charged by the law and by the conscience. Neglect is ultimately a question of an intent to forego parental duties. And so...
Where does that come from?
Your Honor, in my brief, I think I cite there to the JMJ case.
The reason I ask that is because neglect isn't a matter of intent. Abandonment's a matter of intent, but neglect is a matter of fact as to whether they did it or didn't do it, isn't it?
Well, I cited both the JMJ and CMBR. And I would suggest that neglect has to be established, of course, under that clear, cogent, and convincing standard that instantly tilts the scales.
Well, but isn't that the trial standard? As far as sufficiency of the evidence, it's all the evidence reviewed in the light most favorable to the judgment, with the idea that the trial court can believe all part or none of the evidence. So that's the trial court standard, but it isn't the standard of review as to whether or not there's substantial evidence to support the judgment. We don't reweigh the evidence based upon the burden of proof any more than we would reweigh the evidence in a criminal case.
Right. Your role under the Murphy against Karen case is to make a determination as to whether that judgment was supported by substantial evidence or was it, for example, against the weight of the evidence. And I would suggest to you, based on what you have before you, that clearly, whether you go by the weight of the evidence standard as I outlined in my brief, or the substantial evidence standard as was cited in the CMBR case, that the trial court committed error such that you should send it back and order them to dismiss or deny that petition.
The neglect is defined or set out in the 211.447 as being repeated or continuous failure by the parent, although physically or financially able, to provide the child with adequate food, clothing, shelter, or education as defined by law, or other care and control necessary for the child's physical, mental, or emotional health and development. I understand that's in 211. Is there a different definition or meaning of neglect in a 553 case?
I think under the adoption and foster care chapter 453, as it relates or interplays with chapter 211, I think courts certainly have drawn from the 211 factors in order to buttress or justify decisions under the 453 chapters. They're two separate chapters. There isn't a definition that specific is laid out in, as you rightly point out, in 453. Certainly, I think that it can be something a court can look to for guidance, but it isn't something that a court has to evaluate, find, and then decide with respect to a 453 decision.
Is there evidence in the record that father provided the child with food, clothing, shelter, or education during the relevant time period?
So that's an interesting issue in this case. The child was born in California in 2010. Well, less than a year later, mother moved 1,700 miles east to St. Louis. At the time of the trial in this case, the child had not yet attained school age, wasn't old enough to play soccer, for example, and father lived in California. And so in asking that question, right before I answer it, I'd like to focus on the importance of that distance in your evaluation of this case. It isn't as though dad lived in an apartment down the street and we can judge him for his conduct in that case based on his proximity. He lived 1,700 miles away and in the 6 months prior to filing of the petition visited St. Louis 3 to 4 times. Circling back to the question you asked about his failure under the 211 standard to provide education, clothing, dad visited frequently. He couldn't pay for soccer or school. He couldn't do homework with the child as there was none. But with respect to the monetary issue, the testimony at trial, uncontroverted, is that father routed money that he received from a trust through his own mother's checking account where he lived to mother in St. Louis for some 4 or 5 years.
Did the trial court find that was not credible testimony?
Yes. So what the trial court did in that case is the trial court said, I don't believe you. And as we all know, oral testimony can be as probative as documentary evidence. I won't say his name because of the audio recording, but the natural father testified at trial on his own behalf. His mother did not travel from California with him. The trial court simply had his testimony about how he routed that money. And the trial court made a decision in its judgment when it signed the judgment prepared by the petitioners that the court found that testimony not credible.
However, we're under our standard of review, we're compelled to accept those findings by the trial court, correct?
Well, you're compelled to give them deference. You're not compelled to rubber stamp them.
We are compelled to find the evidence in the light most favorable to the judgment in the trial court's findings.
Yes, ma'am. And even if you do that, I would suggest to you that even if we accept the trial court's finding with respect to the money, that still doesn't close that issue.
And that's what I'm asking you. What is the evidence of any kind of physical or financial support or other care or control necessary for the child's physical, mental, or emotional health and development?
So I want to make sure I understand your question. If we factor out...
If we assume from the trial court's findings that grandmother paid that money, mm-hmm, and natural father did not, what is in the record that is consistent with the findings as to natural father's providing for the child?
I would say three things in response to that. The first thing I would say is who paid is a distinction without a difference in the sense that mother doesn't deny that she received the money. Secondarily, what did father himself do? Well, we have to evaluate that in the context of the age of the child. And we can't evaluate what father did or didn't do outside the money issue without assuming that father knew his mother was doing that, because then the question is, what did he do? Well, the answer is nothing, right? I mean, he traveled to St. Louis. He would meet his child as he could, based on what mother would allow, but he wouldn't necessarily know that he has to do anything beyond that, because he himself has the knowledge that he's making those payments. So to ask me, if the trial court made that finding that that wasn't credible, that the money moved through grandmother, by not giving deference to where the money came from, then I don't know that I can answer that, because he didn't operate in a world that didn't have that occurring.
He didn't what?
He assumed that there was money being paid routed through mom, and so to ask what he did outside of that, I think, might be unfair to father, in the sense that if he believes that money's moving.
So unless we find that father gets credit for grandmother's, if we don't find that, is there something to support... is there evidence in the record that father supported the child in ways other than that money?
Well, if the answer is monetary, other than spending the money to come to visit her and his time in her presence, you know, I think, you know, whatever an airline ticket costs from California to Missouri and back again every other month or two, with respect to the money he spent when they spent their time together, if that has value, and then dovetailing back into the court, the appellate court decisions that have found that even if you make a determination, by a court makes a determination that no money was spent, that doesn't end the neglect analysis.
Thank you, counsel. I'm sorry.
That's fine.
Thank you.
May it please the court. My name is Jonathan Glassman of Stange Law Firm, and I represent the respondents in this matter, who are the natural mother and the adoptive stepfather of the minor child. In this case, the trial court granted a judgment of adoption and termination of parental rights, finding that appellant willfully abandoned and neglected the child for at least 6 months prior to filing, and that the adoption was in the child's best interests. Because abandonment and neglect are in the disjunctive under Chapter 453.040, the trial court judgment should be affirmed unless both points 1 and 2 of appellant's brief are granted. Granting only one of the 2 points would be insufficient to reverse the judgment in this matter. Adoption judgments are reviewed for an abuse of discretion standard. Greater deference is given to trial court's findings and credibility determinations in adoption proceedings than in other cases. In step-parent adoption appeals, the court must accept as true the evidence and inferences favorable to the judgment and disregard all contrary evidence and inferences. Both of appellant's points on appeal effectively require this court to draw unfavorable inferences to the judgment or to consider contrary evidence and inferences. Appellate courts should not...
Is that the standard of review? I understand that's the standard of review under a sufficiency claim. His claim is against the weight. Are we still... I don't see how you can comply with Murphy's requirement to review something as being against the weight if you ignore all contrary evidence and inferences.
maybe inferences, but certainly contrary evidence, how could anything ever be against the weight if you ignore all the contrary evidence?
Well, Your Honor,
it's not your fault. This is an area that has been messed up. I'm just asking you if you have any insight into it. We can't certainly apply the same rules to both claims, or you're going to always get the same answer.
Well, yes, Your Honor, and there is a case law cited in the respondent's substitute brief providing that the weight of the evidence means the probative value, not the quantity. So the trial court was soundly within its discretion to give more weight to the evidence that the appellant had no emotional ties to the child and frequently missed visits with no explanation than it did to the evidence that there were some phone calls or some visits. In general, appellants should not disturb an adoption judgment unless the welfare of the child requires another disposition or there is a firm belief that the judgment is wrong. In this case, the evidence viewed under the appropriate standard does not support a firm belief that the judgment is wrong or that the welfare of the child requires a reversal. An adoption judgment should be affirmed unless it's so arbitrary and unreasonable as to shock the sense of justice and indicate lack of careful consideration. Appellate courts may not reevaluate testimony through their own perspective. This court has previously held in the Essex Contracting versus Jefferson County case that appellate courts are not in the position of second-guessing a trial court's evaluation and weighing of evidence. The Essex case further provides that in cases where witness testimony is so crucial, it is especially important to exercise proper deference to the trial court's judgment. So long as there is credible evidence on which a trial court can formulate its beliefs, an appellate court may not substitute its judgment to reach a different result. In this case, the adoption judgment was not against the weight of the evidence. There was ample testimony from witnesses the trial court found to be credible that supported its findings of abandonment and neglect. Furthermore, the issue of fundamental liberty is really not germane to this appeal. The Troxell versus Granville case is not on point because it involved the constitutionality of a third-party visitation statute in the state of Washington. Likewise, that CMBR case is not on point because it did not review findings of abandonment or neglect, and it wound up the reversal was based on grounds that they failed to order a post-placement assessment. Although parental rights are a fundamental liberty, there's no indication in this case that appellant's parental rights were terminated without due process under the law.
Could we focus? You have both the grounds of abandonment and neglect.
Yes, ma'am.
And what's the standard for abandonment?
Abandonment focuses on a parent's intent, and a parent cannot avoid abandonment by maintaining superficial or tenuous relationships with the children.
The intent, though, is whether they intend to maintain a relationship with their child.
The intent to withhold care, love, and protection and presence. I think it's the intent to maintain a parental relationship, not just any communication.
Well, in looking at the standard, did the trial court find that natural father had visited on 3 to 4 occasions in the 6 months prior to the filing of the petition?
Without looking at the exact judgment, I don't know exactly word for word.
He did travel. Did he also make phone calls?
Yes, there was evidence that he visited and made phone calls in that six-month period. Yes, Your Honor.
And they were daily or weekly phone calls, right?
I think there was conflicting testimony on how often there were, but I mean, I think it was.
Well, it wasn't conflicting. They were at least that often, right? Weekly?
I believe at least once a week. Yes, Your Honor.
In fact, I'm looking at the judgment, and I'm not sure whether I'm seeing that that's what the evidence was or the trial court's finding, but it talks about 3 times every week.
Yes, there was testimony that it was 3 times a week. I mean, I think there was also at some point they said, well, almost every day or 3 times a week, so I think it was in that ballpark.
How's that abandonment?
Because the judge looked at the totality of the evidence. So,
why was the judge right? If you talk on the phone 3 times a week, I'm asking, and you visit every month or two during the 6 month period, how, as a matter of law, was that error? Just call that abandonment?
Your Honor, no, it was not. despite the presence of some visits and phone calls, well, one of those visits, the child was not even in St. Louis. So I don't think that counts as one of the visits, one of the times he flew to St. Louis. There was a finding of a superficial relationship with the child. There was a finding that the person lacked, the appellant lacked emotional ties and commitment to the child, which is consistent with the withholding of care and love. They found that he missed scheduled visits without justifiable excuses. And they were able to consider not just the actual contact, but the nature and quality of his time and interactions with the child. The chronic lateness and missed visits, telling the child he was going to fly out to St. Louis and then not even coming, and also evidence that he was ignoring the child during visits.
And these were on repetitive occasions. I think, was there 20 times that he indicated he was going to come and didn't show up, and very numerous times that he was substantially late?
Yes, Your Honor. It was not just a one-time thing. It was many times, both during the six-month statutory period and prior to that.
Yeah.
Other evidence of the abandonment, looking at the totality of everything, there was evidence he does not make the child a priority during his visits. The GAL observed no eye contact between the appellant and the child, that he failed to appreciate the importance of his GAL observed visit, and missed one-third of that GAL observed visit the day before the trial.
Are there cases addressing whether this kind of evidence is sufficient to constitute abandonment or whether it goes to some other ground?
Well, yes, there are cases that even where there is some level of contact, they've still found abandonment. There are several of them.
Well, sure. I mean, there's some that say a visit or two, but anything like this where you're saying it's the quality of the contacts, even though they were numerous, that makes it abandonment. Is there a case like that?
Well, the JMJ case goes to that. It shows that there's a lack of emotional support. It showed that during those visits that did occur, the natural mother paid more attention to the grandparents than to the child. So the sporadic visits and lack of involvement can be a sign of abandonment, even if there are some visits or phone calls, Your Honor.
Could you address, under neglect, it's a failure to provide support, and then there is some question as to whether minimum contact is also required. In other words, that you have to fail to provide support and fail to maintain contact.
Yes, sir.
Is that correct? And if it is, how does that interact with abandonment? What level, is there a level of contact that's sufficient to avoid neglect but insufficient to avoid abandonment?
Well, my reading of the case law is that it's not the amount of contact, it's a failure to provide meaningful contact. There's a Supreme Court case which reversed an adoption judgment. It was the RAB case, which found that I think the child spent maybe up to 2 weeks consecutively with the natural father in the 6 months prior to the adoption. So that was clearly a meaningful contact, and there was also financial support provided, which was clearly from the natural father, not from a grandmother. So I believe in a case like that, we look at the nature and quality of the contact. I think a lot of these phone calls were a minute long, hi, how are you, okay, bye. I think
Finish up. Go ahead.
A lot of times the child even said, stop calling me so often.
So there's been a lot of talk about whether the father or grandmother made the payments, and the trial court found it was the grandmother. But where's the case that says you can't have your relatives make the payments? I mean, because a lot of people don't have money and their families help them. I know we have a case where someone had some disabilities and they had to have family members assist with care, and it was argued that they couldn't provide the care themselves and therefore they neglected or abandoned, and we said no, you know, you can, we're a village basically, and you can have other people assist you. You're not expected to do it all by yourself.
Well, Your Honor, the inquiry for neglect is whether the parent has performed his or her duty that they are charged with by law or conscience, not whether...
I'm saying the cases don't say you have to do it personally if you provide for it. Otherwise, anybody who has a nanny would have their children taken. You're providing for the child through others.
Well, I believe in the situation with a nanny, there'd be evidence that the parent actually paid for the nanny's services.
And is there a case that says you have to actually pay, or is the question whether the child is provided for?
Well, I believe the question is whether the parent is actually paid.
And what's the case for that?
Well, the BSR case, which is out of the Western District, provides that the availability of funds from other sources does not relieve a parent of their obligation to support other children.
Thank you.
Well, might it turn on whose obligation is being fulfilled. If the mother's mother provides him with money, there's no suggestion that that's fulfilling the father's duty. But the father's mother steps in. I'm not sure how that's any different than if the father had found the money on the sidewalk.
Well, it goes to what is his own effort to support this child. The testimony that he took this money out of his trust and gave it to his mother to pay the respondents, that was invalidated.
He set that aside because the trial judge didn't believe it. But the trial judge seemed to believe that the grandmother was fulfilling father's obligation. Maybe not with father's money, but was fulfilling father's obligation.
Right. And I believe that the trial court is in a better position to judge the intent of the grandmother paying that money, and perhaps based on the father's testimony and all the evidence and testimony and documents that were throughout the case, that the trial judge determined that she was not doing it on behalf of the father. She was doing it because she wanted to still maintain a relationship with her grandchild. There was other evidence that was admitted into evidence at the trial that there was a text message from grandmother to mother saying, "Hey, what's your bank account so I can wire the money?" And father was trying to say, "Oh yeah, this is evidence that I was trying to pay her the money." And so even he was like dishonest about who the message was coming from, and that was found that, okay, this is really about grandmother's desire to maintain a relationship with the grandchild. That coupled with some of the visits that mother and the child made out to California, the father didn't even really participate in them. So a lot of those were even with grandmother, and so it was very well possible that grandmother wasn't doing this because of a father's obligation to support. She was doing it because of her own care about the granddaughter.
What was the evidence of the father's income? Did he have substantial monies?
Well, there was also very conflicting evidence. His tax returns for the past 3 years prior showed he had income of, you know, between $2,000 to $3,000 a year. And then I think in his discovery answers to interrogatories, he said he earned around $20,000 a year. And then at the trial, he said, "I have a trust and I use that money to pay this support. I give it to my mother and then she electronically transfers it." The other issue is that he has a sound engineering degree, so it's a little skeptical that someone who can operate sophisticated audio equipment wouldn't know how to use electronic banking in this day and age. So the court could consider all of that in saying that appellant did not support the child. So in conclusion, the trial court decision was based on evidence that grandmother paid the money to respondents, combined with a lack of corroborating evidence that it came from appellant. For the court to revisit whether the funds from appellant's mother qualified as support paid by appellant is outside the permitted scope of appellate review. The EKL case mentioned by opposing counsel, that's not on point either, because in that case, the father was incarcerated, did not personally send money. The paternal grandmother provided some diapers and food prior to the 6-month statutory period, and the father claimed he had directed the grandmother to provide the support that precluded a finding of neglect, but that finding of neglect was affirmed. This is distinguishable because, in this case, for one, appellant was not incarcerated, so he could have tried to find the money to pay this.
Counselor, you're out of time.
All right. I was just going to say the EKL holding would not necessarily be different if there were stronger evidence of contributions by grandmother or request by father for grandmother to contribute. Thank you.
Counselor, if we take the trial court's credibility findings as they are and then weigh the evidence, what is there that you produce that convinces us immediately that the trial court's judgment on neglect was wrong?
I think that's exactly the right question, in the sense that Judge Breckenridge asked me about, you know, if we factor out the monthly payments from grandmother. And as I put my thinking cap on as I was sitting at a counsel table, it strikes you that it's immediately wrong, because when you have cases before you on
the credibility termination or the weight of the evidence.
Weight of the evidence, Your Honor.
Okay.
With respect to these termination cases, you usually read the first paragraph of the facts and it's kind of clear how the case is going to shake out because you have parents who are not involved, have no contact, provide no support.
It appears to me his desire goes to abandonment.
Yes.
His performance goes to neglect.
Yes, and his
performance. So that's why I'm particularly focusing on neglect.
Yes, sir.
Explain to me why there isn't sufficient evidence in this record, or that the evidence that the trial court accepted as true, which you admit there was sufficient evidence of. What is there about that determination that immediately tilts the scales for us that should lead us to believe that the trial court was wrong?
If we go beyond the money that was sent by Grandma, we look at his many numerous trips to St. Louis, both before, during, and after the statutory period.
Those show a desire to see him, so that's an abandonment scale.
Well, it's also intent in the sense that, Judge, if you don't have the intention to see your child, you wouldn't spend the money to come see the child, the 3 times a week phone calls. Counsel just told you that the length of the phone calls goes to the quality of the contact. Well, this is a child that's 4 or 5 years old. I challenge any of us to have a conversation with a 4 or 5 year old that lasts more than a minute or so.
And again,
those are performance.
That makes sense to me from the abandonment prong. But you don't feed or clothe your child through a phone call. You don't feed or clothe your child by buying a plane ticket for you to go visit the child. I understand how that affects the abandonment analysis.
Sure.
I'm looking for something from you in the record that demonstrates, based upon the findings of the trial court, that demonstrates he provided for the care of this child.
So here's what I have for you. As I think as a family lawyer about trial courts making those same determinations when a parent pays for air conditioning, pays for rent, pays for gasoline, pays for school tuition, you're not giving the child money or clothes, but you're clearly supporting them. I would analogize this case with respect to father spending the time with his child as evidence of that. It's that time with dad. It is the meals out. It is the time dad has with that child. Mom moved that child 1,700 miles east, so there has to be some value. There has to be some recognition of that time with dad when he's here as being analogous to a parent paying for rent or gasoline. It's beneficial. In addition, he does have those expenses when he's here of the hotel room. And for the child, perhaps it's a meal out where mom would always make sure that she sat there with dad and supervised his visits. It's clear he isn't going to win Dad of the Year, but he also has provided enough evidence to the trial court for you to reverse that decision based on the standard you have before you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.